You are listening to the Tiny Giant Losses podcast. Tiny Giant Losses is a collection of resources empowering women to heal after reproductive loss of any kind. Welcome to the podcast, Baby Loss Mamas. Now that we've completed our series on six steps of healing, we're continuing our new series on various types of reproductive loss and healing after them. We started off our series with the topic of pregnancy after loss. This episode, we're talking about infant loss. And later episodes will focus on specific types of loss, such as miscarriage or stillbirth, as well as on healing after loss, including a roundtable discussion with several leaders in the baby loss field. So, as I mentioned, this episode's focus is on infant loss. Along with miscarriage, this is one of the types of loss I've personally experienced, so I'm especially grateful for the opportunity to share this episode with you. We'll start off by discussing some research on infant loss, then we'll talk about the implications for healing, as well as the implications for those who are supporting you after infant loss. We'll then share an interview with April Boyd from the Love and Loss Project, review a film on infant loss, and list a few celebrities who've experienced infant loss too. Let's dive in. According to the Centers for Disease Control, there were about 3,700 sudden unexpected infant deaths in the United States in 2015 alone. The CDC defines sudden unexpected infant death, also called SUID or SUID, as the death of an infant less than 1 year of age that occurs suddenly and unexpectedly, and whose cause of death is not immediately obvious before investigation. The National Institutes of Health, or NIH, clarifies SUID classification somewhat by adding, SUID indicates all unexpected deaths, those without a clear cause, such as SIDS, and those from a known cause, such as suffocation. One half of all SUID cases are SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome. Many unexpected infant deaths are accidents, but a disease or something done on purpose can also cause a baby to die suddenly and unexpectedly, and thus be part of SUID as well. Although it seems a little bit redundant, the SUID category of infant loss includes SIDS, which is at this time considered to be an unknown cause, as well as another category called unknown cause. So what gives? The distinction between SIDS and unknown causes here is that a SIDS determination includes, in most cases, a complete autopsy, an examination of the death scene, and a review of the clinical history, whereas a so-called unknown cause doesn't typically include those elements. Of the 3,700 SUIDs in 2015, about 1,600 of the deaths were from SIDS. So that makes SIDS the leading cause of death among infants 1 to 12 months old. And that's not even counting the unknown cause deaths that didn't have the additional investigation to determine whether or not they're SIDS. The CDC also cites another major cause for infant loss, which is accidental suffocation and strangulation in a bed. This is sometimes also known as sleep-related causes of infant death. To be clear, this is not necessarily associated with co-sleeping. That's a common myth in the U.S., but often this is completely independent of co-sleeping. The CDC defines this category of infant loss to include suffocation by soft bedding, for example, if a pillow or a waterbed covers an infant's nose and mouth. It's called overlay, which was when another person rolls on top of or against an infant while sleeping. Wedging or entrapment, which is when an infant gets wedged between two objects, such as a mattress and a wall, a bed frame, or furniture. And strangulation, which may happen, for example, if an infant's head and neck gets caught between crib railings. The CDC website goes on to explain that even after a thorough investigation, it can be hard to tell SIDS apart from other sleep-related infant deaths, such as overlay or suffocation by soft bedding. Quote, this is because these deaths are often unwitnessed, and there are no tests to tell SIDS apart from suffocation. To complicate matters, people who investigate SUIDs may report cause of death in different ways and may not include enough information about the circumstances of the event from the death scene. End quote. I've spoken with one baby loss mother who said her doctor wouldn't put SIDS on her infant's death certificate because, quote, he didn't believe in it. So it's possible that reporting differences can make a statistical difference here too, especially since the determination is hard to make and opinions can run pretty strong on the matter. That said, there are some numbers available on these types of losses. According to the CDC, 43% of cases were categorized as sudden infant death syndrome. That's followed at 32% by unknown cause, which may include sudden infant death syndrome cases that were not fully investigated. And that's followed by accidental suffocation and strangulation in bed, which is about 25% of SUIDs. That translates to about 1,600 deaths in 2015 due to SIDS, 1,200 due to unknown causes, and about 900 due to accidental suffocation and strangulation. Of course, there are other rarer types of infant loss. These include heart failure, other major organ failure, deaths due to labor-related injuries, pathogen-related death, and neglect. So there are a lot of potential causes of infant loss, and the main one is SIDS. So let's look more at SIDS. At present, the cause of SIDS is unknown. The current theory involves what's called the triple risk model. Basically, the triple risk model states that there are three different factors that, when combined, may cause SIDS. These factors include 1, brain abnormalities or genetic disorders. 2, the timing, which involves a critical developmental period. 2, timing, which involves a critical developmental period. These are normal in the first 6 months of life, but they may destabilize the infant's internal systems temporarily or periodically, making them more susceptible to death at that time. And 3, outside stressors. These include upper respiratory tract infections, stomach sleeping positions, secondhand tobacco smoke. While none of these factors alone causes infant death, it's believed that this combination of factors may be what causes SIDS. There are different initiatives around the world for reducing the occurrence of SIDS. The largest and most successful ones relate to infant sleep practices. According to the National Institutes of Health, the single most effective action that parents and caregivers can take to lower a baby's risk of SIDS is to place the baby to sleep on his or her back for naps and at night. Quote, compared with back sleeping, stomach sleeping carries between 1.7 and 12.9 times the risk of SIDS. The mechanisms by which stomach sleeping might lead to SIDS are not entirely known. Studies suggest that stomach sleeping may increase SIDS through a variety of mechanisms, including increasing the probability that the baby rebreathes his or her own exhaled air, leading to carbon dioxide buildup and low oxygen levels, causing upper airway obstruction, and interfering with body heat dissipation, leading to overheating. Evidence from countries around the world, including New Zealand, Sweden, the United States, suggests that placing babies on their back to sleep results in a substantial decline in the SIDS rate compared to placing babies on their stomachs to sleep. Researchers have established the link between stomach sleeping and SIDS by showing that babies who died from SIDS were more likely to be put to sleep on their stomachs compared with babies who lived. Public health campaigns promoting back sleep positioning led to dramatic decreases in SIDS rates. Plus, in areas where stomach sleeping is rare, such as in Hong Kong, SIDS rates historically were very low and continue to be very low, which further strengthens the association between back sleeping and lower rates of SIDS. According to the CDC, SIDS rates have decreased by about two-thirds between 1990 and now, most likely thanks to public education about sleep positioning. The NIH adds that placing babies on their backs to sleep is not associated with any risks or other problems. For example, sometimes you might hear the idea that, well, what if they spit up or vomit and then they choke on the vomit? That's not actually an issue with back sleeping positions. So now we know that we can't control the risk of SIDS entirely based on current knowledge, but that we can reduce its odds of occurrence by as much as 12.9 times with good sleep practices. However, there are some concerns out there about other supposed factors in SIDS, and I'd like to take a moment to address some of these myths. According to the NIH, SIDS is not contagious. That's one myth out there. SIDS is not the result of neglect or child abuse. And if anybody tells you that it is, that's ridiculous. SIDS is not caused by cribs, unlike accidental suffocation, which has some association with certain types of unsafe cribs. SIDS is not caused by vomiting or choking. SIDS is not completely preventable, but there are ways to reduce the risk, as we've discussed. And this last one is important here because it's been kind of a hot topic lately. SIDS is not caused by vaccines, immunizations, or shots. That last one is getting to be a really widespread myth due to some very misguided, well-intentioned, but misguided ideas about vaccines. I keep seeing this claim that SIDS is caused by vaccines. And while I certainly don't advocate getting all the vaccines, every single one of them, or getting vaccines all at once, or anything like that, I'd like to inject, a little reality into the situation here. So while vaccines are not always 100% safe, there is absolutely no medical evidence whatsoever that they cause SIDS. According to the CDC, multiple research studies have been conducted to look for possible links between vaccines and SIDS. Results from these studies and continued monitoring show that vaccines do not cause SIDS. There's been research in depth, repeatedly, and there is simply no link between SIDS and vaccines. And claims to the contrary are putting children at unnecessary risk of things that are actually deadly, like diphtheria and whooping cough and streptococcus pneumonia. That last one, for example, can cause serious infections, including meningitis and pneumonia, which can be fatal in young children. Before infants were routinely immunized against this particular disease in the United States, there were approximately 17,000 cases of invasive disease each year among children younger than 5 years old, including 700 cases of meningitis and 200 DUGs. And if you're listening to this and you're getting riled up and you're saying, well, why should I trust you rather than trusting bloggers X, Y, and Z? I mean, your baby died. What do you know? I want to be very clear here. My baby died at less than 1 day old prior to any vaccines of any kind. And you'd better bet that I will responsibly vaccinate my next child to prevent losing another infant for a reason like unfounded medical beliefs based on some kind of alternative facts. I highly encourage you to clear your mind of preconceived notions about vaccines and look at the actual facts about vaccine risks, which do exist but are extremely low and totally unrelated to SIDS, before risking your child's life to disease unnecessarily. Thank you for listening and for considering it. Okay, so that was a lot of technical, head-based stuff. Let's turn a little bit more to the heart side of things. Losing an infant can be, obviously, absolutely heart-wrenching, whether it's from known causes or from unknown causes. And it can be a challenge to overcome in large part because, just like miscarriage and stillbirth and infertility and the like, it's a form of grief that we're more likely to face with limited support compared to the loss of an adult. Unlike losing an older child or an adult loved one, it can be challenging for the community to mourn alongside you or to support you in your mourning of an infant. In my experience, and in the experiences of many other baby lost mothers I've spoken with about their losses, most people want to do something, but have no idea what to do. So, over at the Tiny Giant Losses page on Patreon, you can download a free printable guide for asking those around you for support after a loss, including infant loss, as well as other types of reproductive loss. And this can empower them to be there for you in constructive, supportive ways that they might not otherwise be capable of initiating on their own. There's a link to that in this episode's description. And in particular, the unexpectedness of losing an infant to SUID can increase the odds of trauma around the loss. Personally, I was diagnosed with PTSD last year and am now nearly completely symptom-free thanks to the many healing approaches I discuss here on the podcast and on the Tiny Giant Losses website. So if you're dealing with loss-related trauma, I encourage you to listen to more episodes of the podcast where we share many, many resources, to find a skilled therapist to talk with, and to explore more resources at tinygiantlosses.com. Even if you're dealing with social difficulties and or PTSD in addition to the incredible grief of losing an infant, there's still a lot you can do to heal. Joining a support group and attending therapy are popular options for healing and can be quite effective for many people. Reading and writing are too. holding a funeral and other ceremonies can bring some sense of peace and closure around the loss. And creating ritual and meaning surrounding your loss is a powerful tool for healing too. You can access information about these and many other healing approaches through the Tiny Giant Losses website at tinygiantlosses.com. And of course, we recommend different resources on each podcast episode. Speaking of which, it's time for our 2-minute review. This episode's 2-minute review is of Losing Layla, a film by Vanessa Gorman, whose book Layla's Story is also on our recommended resources list. Losing Layla is an Australian documentary film that Vanessa started shooting before she and her partner, Michael, even conceived Layla. In an email to me, Vanessa described the film as more of a home movie than a documentary, and although it's a relatively simple documentary, it captures the incredible depths of grief that are so rarely shown in film. Losing Layla began as a documentation of Vanessa's disagreement with Michael about having a child and their shared love over the course of 3 years. When Vanessa was 39, they conceived, and the story became about bringing this child into the world, with Vanessa full of longing and Michael full of ambivalence. And then the film shifts to the topic of Vanessa's difficult labor, the complications, the pain, the hours of agony, the difficult decisions that so many women know all too well, and to infant loss due to meconium inhalation. What follows is the most intimate look at the grief of reproductive loss that I've ever seen on film. It is so deeply personal and raw and honest, and it captures the intensity of grief and the inexplicable moments of grief when you find yourself laughing or singing or shifting in a heartbeat from calm to sobbing. It shows the incredible gift that Vanessa and Michael and their family shared in getting to spend 4 days with Layla's body, to bathe her, to hold her, to photograph her, and to just be with her, both in the hospital and in her home. It portrays the coming together of family and community around the death and the cremation, as well as the incredible sense of isolation that grief can cause within a community and in public after loss. And it even touches on the profound lessons that a lost baby can bring into our lives, and how one can remain connected with a lost child through ritual, through the creation of sacred space, and even through talking. Watching Losing Layla is a deeply emotional experience that will likely bring up moments of sorrow and grief and joy, as well as pangs of remembrance and connection and love for your own lost baby. Although it's quite difficult to watch in some moments, I highly recommend this film to any couple or woman who has experienced a reproductive loss. In particular, I recommend it to the many women who have experienced stillbirth or infant loss, since many aspects of the film will resonate most deeply in these areas. You can order your own copy online at www.vanessagorman.com for $42 Australian plus shipping and handling. It also comes with a 30-minute documentary regarding Raphael, which is about Vanessa's son, who was born after Layla, as well as a short home movie about their daughter, Francesca, born after Raphael. And just as a side note, we do have 2 more copies of the DVD to share through Tiny Giant Losses on Patreon for subscribers at $5 a month and above. So if you want a copy of the film and you're already considering subscribing, now is a great time to do it. And now it's time for us to discuss celebrity baby loss. Infant loss is much rarer than other types of reproductive loss. However, there are still a few celebrities out there who have lost an infant. The most famous examples include 2 women who are so famous that many people know them by 1 name only. Oprah lost her infant son when she was a teenager, and singer Nina of 99 Red Balloons fame went into cardiac arrest during her first birth due to medical mistakes. Her son, Christopher Daniel, was born disabled and died at 11 months as a result of those same mistakes. These powerful women went on to thrive. Nina is now the mother of 4 children, as well as a successful popular singer here in Germany, where I live. And Oprah is, well, she's Oprah, and it doesn't get much more spectacular and thriving than that. Up next, we have our interview. April Boyd is a private practice MSW therapist, creator of the Baby Loss Survival Guide, and founder of the Love and Loss Project, an online comfort and inspiration station for women who have experienced the loss of a baby, pregnancy, or child. April is committed to turning the tragedy of her daughter's life story into a love story by living her own life as brightly as possible and helping others to do the same. When she's not doing the work she loves to do, you might find her on top of a paddleboard or on the side of a mountain with her partner and her 6-pound Yorkie, Sasha. You can get her free self-care kit and connect with her at lovelossproject.com. April, it's so great to have you on the show.
Hi, Lindsay. Thanks for having me on. I'm happy to be here.
Excellent. So, to get started, could you tell us a little bit more about your story?
Sure. So, I'm a social work therapist by trade, and I spent about the past decade, supporting people through all kinds of trauma and tragedy and change. But in 2014, I was forced to experience something that took me out at the knees. And I was really forced to learn what it really means to survive the unthinkable. I had a little girl named Nora, and she passed away suddenly and unexpectedly when she was only one day old. I had, the pregnancy had been healthy and normal, and one day she just simply stopped breathing in my arms. And obviously at that time, it was like my entire world and everything that I believed to be certain and true about the world that I lived in had really come crashing down. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I remember, you know, thinking that I didn't know for sure how I was going to get out of this. I didn't know for sure how I was going to come through this.
Yeah.
But I was really aware that I knew that I needed to. I remember it truly just kind of hit me one day that if I stayed in this place, of this dark, awful, destructive place that grief throws us into, if I self-destructed, that would become the story that would be told about my daughter, Nora.
Mm-hmm.
That in my circle of friends and family, that, you know, in hushed tones, the story of my daughter's life would become ultimately some version that April was fine and good until Nora happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that is not what I'm willing to put on my daughter. I am not willing to let her take responsibility or have that directed at her, that she would be the reason why her mother was now a mess. And I realized that I needed to turn this tragedy into a love story, that I needed to find a way to return to my life again and to find something to take out of this that would help me to honor her.
Mm. That's beautiful. And so is that how you came to create the Love and Loss Project?
Yeah, so even though I'd worked as a therapist, I realized that there was really, I had a hard time finding what it was that I was looking for at that time and the kind of support that I really knew that I needed. And so I created the Love and Loss Project because I needed to share really what I had learned and what I was learning and to offer that to other people. And I really wanted to bridge some of the isolation that I think exists for women when they experience baby loss.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And during this process, did you ever personally go to therapy?
I did. So I definitely did, because here's kind of the thing for me. I really, really believe that in the idea of making this a little bit easier for ourselves in any way possible. And oftentimes people are surprised to say, oh, you're a therapist, but you go to therapy. and I always kind of think, you know, if we reverse that, if we had, like, we're talking about a dentist that doesn't believe in going to the idea of going to get a cleaning, that would be so weird to me, right? So it's always a bit weird to me if people in some ways aren't going and doing therapy and doing, you know, some kind of a way of getting themselves good support that feels right for them. Mm-hmm. Because I really believe that in the idea, one, of working smarter and not harder, but two, that the magnitude of losing a little one, this is so huge, and this is absolutely worthy of our utmost care and time and attention. And this pain deserves our attention. And so for me, I still actually go to therapy from time to time, because for me, it's really just this tool that helps me to run and keep at optimal levels in my life. So, I had been trained actually last year in this couples therapy model. And for me, you know, if I'm going to offer something, I really have to know that it's good, right? That's kind of just how I operate. And I was really inspired by the training, but I went home to my partner and I was like, you know, what would be really fun? It would be really fun if we went and did our own therapy with this model.
Yeah.
And that this is not really his kind of thing. But he was like, you know, sweetheart, that's not exactly my version of fun, but I will do that with you if that's what you want to do. And I was like, how cool is that? What a great guy. So, yeah. So for me, I still really believe in the idea of just making things easier for us and giving our own self-care and our own wellness really mindful attention and really mindful care. Why would I take better care of my car by taking it in for oil changes and doing all various kinds of tasks that we do to keep various parts of our life running well? But when we are hit with something that is devastating, I think we often get, or people, a lot of people get caught in this idea that I should just be able to do this on my own. And I think that is such agony, and that is such torture. Yes. For me, I very much believe in the idea that grief is a marathon. It is not a short sprint. So anything that I can do that's going to help me to keep that distance moving and going and take care of myself along the way, absolutely, I'm going to do that.
Yeah. I think the marathon metaphor is a great one. And it's, you wouldn't consider not being supported, not receiving support along the way, were you running a marathon, even if it's just the little, you know, cups of water here and there, whatever it is, people cheering on the sidelines, you would welcome that.
And we would recognize that we need that.
Yeah.
We would recognize that there is a system, that this is hard.
Mm-hmm.
And I think so often when people go through really hard stuff, a magnitude of hard stuff, like losing a little one, I think we often fall into this idea of feeling like we should just take care of this on our own. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really tragic in some ways.
Yeah. It seems to me like sometimes, since it is such the magnitude of the grief that you've mentioned, right? It's so big. It seems like a lot of people just decide to try to sweep it under the rug in a way, right? And I'm very much a believer in, you know, there are two ways you can deal with something. You can deal with it now, or you can deal with it later.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean we have to try to bite off more than we can chew. You know, I even believe that sometimes denial is healthy and necessary as a mechanism of self-protection. But that, you know, in so much as we're able, dealing with things piece by piece as soon as we can is often the healthiest way to process a loss. Of course, with self-compassion all along, you know, not overstretching ourselves, just like in your marathon metaphor. But it requires attention, you know, a lot of attention. And that's something people are often afraid of, I find. Do you find that as well?
Yeah, and I really agree with what you're saying, because I think that idea of distraction, right, where I'm going to kind of avoid some of this at times, or I'm going to kind of keep myself busy.
Yeah, or like numbing behaviors, like workaholic behaviors or abusive alcoholic, that kind of, you know, or just zoning out with Facebook or something like that.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, the reality is this stuff is agonizing, and so of course we want to numb out that little bit, right? And of course we want to find a way to get a bit of distance from how awful and real the pain really is. And so I think that use of distraction in some ways can be really good for us, right? Sometimes, you know, the best thing that we can do is give ourselves that bit of a break to go and occupy our mind by trying to think about something else or trying to do something else, just to give ourselves a bit of break from the pain, right? Whether that's going over to your friend's house to hang out for a bit or getting out for a walk just to have that change of scenery, right? And try to change gears from where your thoughts keep taking you. But I think that's absolutely true, that if that becomes our only go-to, or if we take that to a point where we're really just trying to avoid life in general, and we're doing things that then become destructive for us, that I think that that's reality, is that it does come back. And I think for some people, you know, we experience that even the idea of I can't sleep. And when I hear people say that, definitely, you know, there's a big part of that that is just part of grief at times. But I think that there's also that question of, are you distracting yourself from the pain all day? Or is your go-to to try to avoid the pain all day? Because it's going to seep back in, and it's going to grab onto your attention whenever it is that your grip has kind of lightened on it. And that might be when you're going to bed at night, or that might kind of be in 10 years when this kind of just comes all flooding back in. And that's very much a phenomenon, not to scare people, but that's very much a phenomenon that I encountered in my work, with people prior to my experience of loss, is that I'd seen the effect of people really just trying to compartmentalize this as one strategy for years. And I'm just not going to think about that. I'm just not going to go there. But eventually, we have no choice but to go there, because it doesn't go away. And so that's why truly, you know, Lindsay, you doing this podcast, and for anyone listening out there, you have my absolute utmost respect, because I think just the fact that you are showing up to be a part of these conversations is such an incredible sign that you are doing what you need to do to give this care and attention. And how cool is that, really?
So earlier you mentioned going on a walk or visiting a friend as two possible means of, you know, stepping away from the intensity of the pain. And I found those examples really fascinating because they're beneficial to us on a very fundamental level. They provide us with connection with other people, with a source of joy, with connection to nature, with physical exercise, all of these kinds of things. And, you know, obviously, if you're just sitting and clicking on Facebook, you're not going to get that same kind of benefit from the means of distraction. Are there any other ways that you would highly recommend, or maybe some of your personal favorites, for dealing with grief or pain that may feel overwhelming, without overly kind of stuffing feelings or avoiding at the same time?
Yeah, so, and what you said there just got me thinking, because I think that one of the things that makes this really hard for us is we really hold ourselves to our previous expectations and standards of functioning. So even when you were describing that idea of scrolling through Facebook, we all do that, right? We all do that, but there's things that we can do to make that easier and gentle for us. So I really encourage the idea of unfollowing anything that you're seeing in your Facebook feed that rips your heart out, that makes this harder, that is your friend's pregnancy announcements that she does not stop posting. So I think that there really is that thing of these small acts of recognizing that this is huge, that you have the right to feel the way that you feel. Mm-hmm. So when you open up Facebook and you see your friend's little newborn face looking at you, and that feels like just too much today, of course it is. Of course it is agonizing. All of us feel that. So cut yourself some slack. Drop those standards for yourself that say I have to do everything the way that I would have done before my loss and continue to expose myself to these awful, horrible things. And give yourself permission to do this a little bit easier and a little more gentle. Unfollow.
Yeah.
One of the other things that I talked to people about, just going back to that idea of going for a walk, is that I really believe, right, and for me, you know, part of my training has made me very aware of some of the science and research around this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is that when we experience something traumatic, like the loss of a child, our system inevitably is going to go into this high stress response of fight or flight.
Yeah.
And what this means, this is how our system is programmed to deal with stress. This is how we have managed to survive as a species, because our brains are actually programmed to deal with stress by supercharging us with cortisol and adrenaline and all of these things that would be really, really useful if we were trying to get away or defend ourselves physically, if we were being attacked by a bear in the woods, right? That idea of that supercharge of blood and cortisol into our muscles that's going to help us to run away is going to be really useful to us in those kinds of situations. But when it comes to heartbreak, when it comes to grief and loss, our system is still going to go into that threat response of having all of that tense energy, which is sometimes why we kind of get into this thing of like we're pacing or walking around or we can't focus or we can't sit down or we can't concentrate or we just feel like we are on edge and ready to lose it or scream at somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that is because of this is literally how our brains have been programmed to deal with threats.
Yeah.
So there is that thing of getting out and burning it off.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a big believer in the idea of physical movement, whether that's yoga. To me, yoga was a bit of a lifesaver. Mm. There was times where I truly did not have even words to be able to process some of the things that was happening for me and that was coursing through my system. So that idea of moving your body is a way to process the grief and also discharge some of that high revving tension of all of that stress and hormones that's going through our body so that we can actually start dialing that down and come back to baseline where we can catch our breath.
Yeah, valuable approach. I've spoken before on the podcast about PTSD as a response to loss. And I think in the interviews I've done so far, about half of the people I've interviewed have specifically, very specifically, recommended exercise for dealing with grief, stress, PTSD, the whole thing. And that's something that I found to be very beneficial. I personally was diagnosed with PTSD after my loss. Mm-hmm.
Usually, firsthand.
Usually outcomes are not considered to be very good for a PTSD diagnosis. But honestly, I'm doing really well. I mean, it's about a year and a half after my loss now, and you wouldn't guess it, you know. So if you saw me on a daily basis or anything, you would be like, "Oh, really? You were diagnosed with PTSD?" It would be kind of a surprise.
And for those listening, if this is useful just to offer, that PTSD is what happens when our system actually gets kind of stuck in that alarm state, that fight or flight alarm state.
Exactly.
Yeah, and so I think, you know, what you're highlighting is an important thing, that sometimes when we go into this kind of Google search of looking into things, what we see is a lot of, like, worst-case scenario stuff.
Mm.
But the stuff, whether it's PTSD or non-PTSD grief, this stuff is not a life sentence.
Yeah.
But that key thing, and tell me if I'm wrong, but the key thing that it looks like what you've done with your story too, is to really lean into it and own it and do the care that is required. I think it's when we're not doing those things that we hear about those stories that people 20 years later, 30 years later, are still kind of bumping their heads on the exact same symptoms or the exact same problems. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the one, we don't have control over what happens to us, but we very much have control about what we do next.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting to me, the two main components that you were speaking about in terms of healthy responses to grief, one of them is this kind of, unfollow approach, which I refer to as noping out.
Nice.
And essentially it's a boundary setting practice, right? And then the other is the discharge of that high rev tension, which I found one of the responses that I was having with PTSD was anger, feeling a lot of anger, which is not something that I really actively felt in my life very much before that. And I learned how to use anger as an indicator for when my boundaries were being crossed and recognizing that it was time to set that boundary clearly and firmly. So for me, it ended up being an incredibly powerful tool for transformation to have those two components working together, right? So recognizing when I would have that kind of that tension and that like panic and all the crazy hormonal stuff that happens when we're in a state of stress, and go, okay, there's an issue here. And then to be able to deal with it both with things like physical exercise, but also with the kind of unfollowing or saying, you know what, I don't appreciate the way that you speak to me about my loss and I would rather that you not do that, or, you know, whatever it is, right? And just being really clear on both of those fronts, both of which come back to, of course, awareness, ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Very cool. And I think what you're saying is so important. Because I think so often we have this idea that I just need to make the anger stop, or I just need to not feel so upset.
Mm.
And I think that's a bit of a myth, right?
Yeah.
I think that's a bit of an unrealistic expectation that we put on ourselves.
And it can be a kind of self-betrayal, too, in the healing process, I find. If you're like, oh, that's just my problem, I'm just not dealing with it well, or something. It's like, no, it's a valid thing. You know?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, you know, especially as women, I think we often, as our go-to coping strategy, is sometimes to try to talk ourselves out of what we're feeling.
Yeah.
So that we don't risk hurting anybody's feelings, or we don't risk looking like a bitch. And I think that that's just what you're identifying, is that emotions are information.
Yeah.
They just are. And it might be that you're revving a little higher and that your actions are maybe a little out of proportion. And, you know, of course they are. You have every right to that too when you're going through this kind of stuff.
Mm.
But there's information in that.
Yeah.
And I think that anger, I couldn't agree more with what you said. It is really, most of the time, a really strong indication that our boundaries have been crossed,
mm-hmm.
that something is not okay. And I talk to women a lot about the idea that, you know, if you don't have the right now to start setting boundaries in your life or to start asking your sister-in-law to talk to you in a different way, now is the perfect opportunity to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You are a grieving mom. So, of course, things are going to be a bit messy. Of course, you might do that badly at times, as we all do. But you have the perfect opportunity to start saying, here's what I need to be different.
Mm-hmm.
Because so often that kind of stuff, it's not brand new, right? So often, I think going through loss of a little one really brings all of that stuff to the surface,
yeah.
in a really acute way. But oftentimes, you know, for me, I realized that there was kind of things I'd been putting up with for a long time that I was able to handle that before, or it kind of stayed under my radar as even really being a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But then when I went through my experience of loss and I truly was exhausted and I did not have the energy to take care of people or put up with stuff in the same way that I did before, that's when it really, really became evident, right? That,
yeah.
that this is not okay.
Yeah.
And that something really needs to change because I don't have the energy to continue to put your needs ahead of my own, right? So, yeah, it's that hard kind of thing that just truly, I think of grief as being like a magnifying glass, right?
Yeah.
It just really highlights things that have probably needed our attention for a long time, but have now become really critical, right? And really essential if we're going to help ourselves get through this easier.
Yeah. Yeah. And I find this is kind of the hidden gift of grief in a way, right? By bringing all these things to the surface, as you said, it allows us to see them so clearly and to not really push them aside so easily anymore, right? So we're faced with a decision. Do I continue to deal with this in this way that it's amplified or magnified, as you said, even though that doesn't feel sustainable to me? Or do I say, you know what? No, that's not okay. And and get some resolution surrounding something that I've been putting off for, you know, maybe even decades, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So it opens up these incredible possibilities for transformation.
Yeah, it's true. I remember, you know, what's coming to mind as you say that is I remember being shocked in a way at, you know, some of the phone calls I would get where people would, you know, my daughter had just died.
Mm-hmm.
And people would do the kind of like, hey, how are you? How you doing? And then it would really quickly move into like this rant about like their bad boss or like their boyfriend being a jerk or like stuff that just, I'm like, this is meaningless crap right now. And like, maybe the woman whose daughter just died is not the right target audience for this thing that is so, I would die to have that be my biggest problem
right.
today kind of problem, right? And, you know, at the same time, like, some of those things were not brand new phenomenon, right? That like, you all know that one friend who every time you see her text message come in, it's kind of that like cringe because she's just going to take and take and take again, right? And that might be fine when you have lots of energy to give and plenty to share around. But when we go through this stuff, putting our own self-care first is just essential survival.
Mm-hmm.
It just is.
Mm-hmm. And when you're working with people who have experienced loss and they're relaying, you know, stories of people being incredibly insensitive, how do you recommend that they deal with that kind of situation?
Yeah, so I think there's kind of a few parts in this, right? And I think we sometimes, because we are angry and because this is really hurtful, I think we sometimes have this tendency to kind of just say, well, screw them, right? If they can't be a good friend to me now, then they're clearly not a friend and I'm done with her. And I just want to tap the brakes on that a little bit because I think that it could be that that is a one-way relationship that is, you know, collapsing in on itself and you don't have the energy to perpetually just give into it. But I think oftentimes there really is an important step that we need to do first, which is that we need to give people the opportunity to give us what they need. I think that this topic of infant loss and of baby loss is, this is a taboo topic in our culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to think that that idea of I just don't know what to say was kind of a bit of a cop-out. But I've actually become really convinced that that is many times absolutely the case.
Yeah.
People don't know what to say. And when you really step back to me, I'm just a bit fascinated by kind of looking at the context, right? The kind of circles around us and our position in time. And the reality is that when our mothers experience this kind of thing, the kindest thing, the thing that was considered to be the kindest thing that somebody could do for that person at that time was to say nothing at all.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing at all. They were to pretend that it didn't happen, and that was considered the kindness then. So when we are really being the trailblazers here by talking about our loss, by letting it known that we had our loss, by keeping our little ones' ultrasound pictures up in our house where they can be seen and shown that this is a member of our family, by preserving that in our history, we are absolutely creating very new social structures and systems for that. So the reality is we are forced to create our own protocol. Mm-hmm. And I know that that absolutely sucks because there's that idea of like, ugh, now I have to do one more thing. But here's kind of the thing. When my uncle died, we all knew the right steps to do. Mm-hmm. We all knew the expected protocol, right? Mm-hmm. You send a card. You bake a casserole, you show up at the wake, you eat the tiny sandwiches, you tell stories about what a lovely man he was, and then you go home, yeah. Right? When it comes to infant loss, what is the protocol? We don't really have one. We don't really have one. And the thing that sucks about that as a culture is that the women, those of us who go through this, and our partners, are forced to create our own in many ways. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think it's so important to be getting support and to be finding really what that system is that works for you. So I think that that means that we have to take responsibility for being the guardian of our little one's memory. Mm-hmm. For claiming our role as our little one's mother and letting people know how we want them to be spoken about and referred to and what place they have in our family tree. Yeah. That is our job as our child's mother. Mm-hmm. And it is still our job when we lose them. So I know that that's big and that's heavy and that can be hard, really hard. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But again, truly, I have so much love and admiration for the people that are joining these conversations, because I know that in itself is not easy to do. Yeah. So yeah, that's some of my thoughts on that.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing that. Yeah. And just as an aside, I would love to mention to listeners that there is a free document that you can download on the Tiny Giant Losses website that is a kind of checklist that you can send out to people that specifically asks them for different areas in which you would like their help or assistance or support after experiencing a loss. So, for example, calling me often or giving me some space or helping with things like, a meal once a week or something, whatever it might be. And they can kind of go in and check the boxes and send it to different people with different things checked or, however. And it kind of makes asking for some of that component of getting your needs met a little bit easier. And of course, the big picture thing of, deciding your own way to navigate this new terrain of loss and of speaking of loss is a beautiful component to dovetail with that, I find.
Amazing, Lindsay. I absolutely love that you have that to offer people. And I think that highlights such an important point, which is that is different for each person. Mm-hmm. And even when I think of my own experience going through some of that, my needs changed by the day. There might have been a time where, the kindest thing somebody might have done would have been just talking to me about the weather or frivolous stuff, mm-hmm. because it would have been too much for me. And there's times when, I needed that space, or there's times when I needed people to come close. Yeah. So I so love that you're really helping people to make their own needs known. Yeah, that's so powerful and cool.
Yeah, I mean, I think even just asking ourselves the question, what do I want, what do I need, is very powerful in and of itself. So even if we're not using a checklist or whatever tool it is, just becoming more aware of what we need is very powerful, and even beginning to voice that, even if it's not literally voicing it with your voice, but just checking a box and handing somebody a piece of paper, can be a big step for a lot of women. We're often not used to asking for what we really need or even knowing what we really need. It's So I'm glad to be able to provide that tool to help with that.
Yeah, I think it's brilliant. Mm-hmm. And I think that there is something, like you're saying, about that idea that sometimes it's so hard to even wrap our brains around what that might be that we need.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
seeing that in checklist or written down form, I think that's brilliant.
It kind of gives permission to people also to ask. You know, like there are a lot of people who, for example, would be willing to show up with a casserole once a week or whatever it is. But they often don't know, like you said, they don't know the protocol. There isn't an established system for how to deal with it. So they're like, oh, I don't know. Should I ask? It's awkward. You know, but if you just say like, sure, if it works for you, that would be great if you could do that. And then I go, oh, okay, now I know what to do. I can do something.
Yeah, and I think this kind of ties back into what you were saying earlier about that idea that this does force us to grow, right? And this mm-hmm. does force us to, I forget your exact words for it, I think we're describing it, but the kind of light, right, or the good pieces that in some ways are cultivated through this experience, and that, you know, I think that's just such an important point, is that it does force us to ask for what we need.
Yeah.
And that, for most of us, is not a comfortable place. And I think that now is really the essential time to give ourselves permission, like you said,
mm-hmm.
to start accepting and noticing that our needs are valid, that they matter, and that other people cannot read our minds.
Yeah.
They just can't. I think so often when I talk to people or when I talk to couples, it's like this idea that like, well, if they were really a good friend, they would know that I needed them right now. Okay, well, what does that needing them look like? Well, I needed them to call me or check in. Okay, well, that's something you need to let them know.
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
for me, there's times where being a good friend might have been really being understanding the fact that I'm not picking up the phone right now,
yeah.
you know, and I need that space. So that is so unique and personal.
Yeah. So we've talked about a lot of the things that you find support healing. What are some of the things that you find get in the way of healing?
I think that some of the things that get in the way for healing for us is, I think that idea that if I'm strong and if I'm doing this well, then that means I should just work this out on my own. I think that often prolongs the pain.
Mm-hmm.
I think that idea of guilt really can keep us in that dark place for a lot longer. And what I mean by that is I think that one of the things that makes it really hard to start to let ourselves rise after this, is that it can often feel like we are betraying our lost little beloved and that we're leaving them behind.
Mm-hmm.
And often when I talk to people, and I know from my own self, there's that idea that, you know, if I'm laughing or if I'm experiencing joy again, then maybe I'm somehow sending the message to others or to my lost little one that this doesn't matter or that I'm over it.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be such a catch-22, right? That yeah. there's people here who need me to function and return to life again. But maybe that's wrong, or maybe I'm being a bad mom to my lost little one if I'm doing that. And so I see a lot of people get really stuck in that limbo place between loss and life. And for me, one of the ideas that really I grabbed onto to help pull myself out of that darkness that I offer to other people is I believe that our lost little one would want us to be happy again.
Yeah.
I believe that my daughter would want me to live my life as brightly as I can. And that is truly my commitment of how I choose to honor her and the fact that her life existed
mm-hmm.
is by doing the hard work of returning to life again. I think so often one of the many things that's taken from us through this is this opportunity to show our love for our child. And I think that what that means is that one of the only avenue that we have available to us, the only outlet for that becomes our misery and our tears, mm-hmm. and in many ways our destruction. That is how I will show my love for my little one. That is how I will honor them. And so we kind of, I feel like sometimes we can kind of merge with our pain, right? And it becomes important to us. And I get that. But I also think we need to allow ourselves to merge with joy, yeah. and to honor our little one through living life again. Because for me, you know, and I'll just share with you, I didn't really care if I lived or died in some of the earlier stages of my loss. I didn't care. There was times where I truly wished I was dead. And so that idea of returning to life for me, meh, right? That wasn't really going to cut it for me.
Yeah.
But I could very much, what I was able to grab onto is I very much owed it to her.
Mm-hmm.
And I was not willing to let her become the reason why her mother self-destructed.
Right.
So I think we return to life for them.
Yeah, I mean, and in your case, it's, I think you've created a very beautiful legacy for Nora. You know, through rewriting her story into a love story, through the work that you're doing on an ongoing basis. And it allows you to maintain a connection with her. It seems that's very powerful. And at the same time, not have that be rooted in sorrow or despair or grief or a feeling of having been traumatized or anything like that. It's just a complete shift in what the foundation of that story is.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, that's my hope.
Yeah. So, let's see. What is the one thing you want those who are listening right now to know?
If you're listening, I want you to know this. I want you to know that you are going to survive this. I want you to know that you are going to make it through and that you've actually already survived the worst of this. You already have. You've already survived the absolute worst of this and you're going to get through all the days that come next. That is what I want you to know. And I also want to say thank you for really sharing in this with me, too. That's the other thing I guess I want you to know is that I'm grateful for that you are connecting to this conversation because this is one of the ways that I honor my loss, too. So thank you.
Listeners, you can find out more at lovelossproject.com, where April also offers a fantastic free resource. It's called the Baby Loss Survival Guide. Could you just tell us briefly a little bit more about that and what's included with that? Because I think it's such a wonderful resource.
Thank you so much. So the Baby Loss Survival Guide is really where I have combined some of the best tools and therapeutic strategies that I know of with really what I know that it really does take to get through that darkness. And so it's a combination of videos and workbooks that really just make really good support available any time of day, 24/7, because it's an online system that you can access those videos and those modules any time of day, really from anywhere that you have a good internet connection, so that you can know that you're not alone and soak up that support when you need it. So that's what the Baby Loss Survival Guide is. It's basically 7 modules that I believe are really the foundation pieces that we need to get through this in a way that honors both the dark and the need for the light.
Yeah, that's wonderful. So again, listeners, that's at lovelossproject.com. Thank you so much for joining us, April.
Thank you so much, Lindsay, for having me on.
Now it's time for a quick announcement about Tiny Giant Losses. We've simplified our Patreon giving tiers. They're now at $1 a month, which is practically nothing, $5 a month, and $20 a month. You can learn more and get ongoing resources and rewards for subscribing at patreon.com/tinygiantlosses. It's a great time to join because we're currently sharing some bonus rewards for everyone who subscribes. So be sure to check it out. And now we have our baby names listing. All Tiny Giant Losses patrons have the opportunity to have their lost babies named on this podcast. This episode, we're sharing three names. Luna Julianne, Silas Lane, Chinrezig Marilyn James. These babies were lost, but they're still loved. Thank you for joining me for the Tiny Giant Losses podcast. If you found this episode to be healing, visit tinygiantlosses.com to find many more resources to empower your own healing journey. For even more updates and resources, follow us on Twitter at tinygiantlosses and like us on Facebook at facebook.com/tinygiantlosses. Thanks, and until next time, I'm wishing you all the best on your baby loss healing journey.